like to add my greeting to the greeting that has already been extended to all of you. We are encouraged by your presence here, thankful to be worshiping our great God together. I invite you to open your Old Testaments to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. We've been marching through the book of Daniel for the last several weeks now, and this chapter is going to be no less challenging to us than the other chapters have been, or the chapters to come will be after this. I've been really enjoying this study. I think some of you have as well. It's really been challenging to look at God as the king who rules over all the kingdoms of men and sets over the kingdoms whoever he wants to set over. It's really one of the main points of this book. In 521, that is the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned, but that Nebuchadnezzar's, the guy that came after him, failed to learn. We'll study about in chapter 5. You know, Sir Winston Churchill once made a comment in a speech that he was giving to the British Parliament that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And I think when we look at the story of mankind and we pull out our history books, I think we can see plenty of people throughout the story of mankind who learned very, very painful lessons the hard way. But then that generation passes, the next one comes, and that one fails to learn from those lessons, and then, so they make the same mistakes, and everything is repeated. But God will not allow us to ignore him, even though we might ignore the people who came before us. He holds people accountable to him because he is the king. He holds people accountable for what they know, or at least have every opportunity to know, as this man did here in chapter 5. And so we're going to learn about a Babylonian king from God's perspective who failed to learn the lessons that his predecessor discovered. You and I know that God rules, but how well are we doing with applying it? That's the challenge of this book. That's the challenge of this chapter. So open your Bibles, please, to chapter 5. Let's look at the feast that King Belshazzar makes. He makes one for 1,000 of his lords, verse 1, and drinks wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king, as it wrote, then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. And the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. So we are, right off the bat, we're introduced to a character that very, very abruptly kind of comes onto the scene in the book of Daniel. Because for the last four chapters, we have King Nebuchadnezzar at the center point of all of these different stories, and now all of a sudden he's gone, and now King Belteshazzar is now on the throne. So we have fast-forwarded into time in history. Babylon now sits at the very brink of their destruction as an empire. Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, a guy by the name of Labashi Marduk, however you say that, he has been overthrown, and this guy named Nabonidus has taken the reins of the throne. But Nabonidus was a weird guy. He really liked to spend time camping out in the desert for years at a time, dabbling with archaeology, because some ancient kings did that. And so what he does is he hands over Babylon and the rule of the empire, for the most part, over to his son, Belshazzar, the guy in this chapter. And so, notice in verse 7, Belshazzar offers the job of third ruler because he himself is the second in charge after his father Nabonidus. And so five different times in this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar is called the father of Belshazzar, but really that word father is just kind of has the idea of predecessor, the guy who came before you that you're trying to pattern your rule after. And so we're introduced to this new king, and we quickly get a really good sense of the kind of man that he is. Because, as we know from the way that this chapter ends, the Persians and the Medes are knocking on the gates right outside the walls. So what would you think if you were the king, and you were the noblemen, and you were the concubines and wives, what would you be doing about this time that Babylon's armies are getting defeated out there and this massive army is descending upon you? You might think that you might be wearing sackcloth, prostrate in the temple of your gods. But that's not where we find Belshazzar or all of his people, his women, and his high-up guys. They're partying. And it seems mostly even a drinking party at that. Because Babylon's walls are high, after all, nobody can get us. We're safe here. So we're going to whoop it up and pretend like nothing bad is happening and kind of bring some things into the room to make it appear like we're conquerors. Because we've conquered before, right? And so during the feast, he orders that the temple vessel be brought in. Even to pagan eyes, this was sacrilegious. You don't take dedicated items of a god and bring them into your banqueting hall and use them for your wine. Why did they do this? Did they run out of goblets? You know, did the official person back in the kitchen who was washing all the dishes just fall down on the job? No, this is intentional. This is sending a signal. It seems to be doing something like this. Oh, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was a great conqueror, but my little finger is thicker than my father's loins, as Rehoboam might have said. And so he seems to be bringing out the symbols of Babylon's glorious past in order to say, we've got nothing to worry about with the enemy outside. Our gods have triumphed before, and they will triumph again. And so he brings them out, he puts wine in them, they drink from them, and then they praise some unnamed gods. Daniel doesn't even bother to tell us the names of these idols that they were worshiping and serving. All he does is just tell us about the materials that they were made out of. And he leaves it at that. Belshazzar has spit in the face of the God of gods, and he is going to regret it, even though he doesn't know it yet. But then something very dramatic happens, and if you've been tracking in the book of Daniel, things have been dramatically happening all throughout this book, and chapter 5 is no less exciting, I think, even though maybe a lot of us have grown up hearing about these stories in our Bible classes. Can you just imagine living through this wild experience? Verse 5 tells us, the king didn't see a vision. He didn't have a dream. He didn't see the appearance of something that wasn't actually there, like a mirage. He actually saw the fingers of a human hand without any body attached to it. I mean, this sounds like an episode of the Addams Family, but it's not. It is real life. This actually happened. Can you imagine sitting in the room and here you're toasting Marduk or whatever god that you're worshiping, and here it is in whatever size it appeared, and it's right up there for people to see, and it's doing what it's doing. This disembodied appendage just appears out of nowhere and writes this mysterious message that nobody can read, which just makes the situation scarier, I think. And so he yells for his dream team to come in and tell him what in the world this means. And for the third time in the book of Daniel, the magicians of Babylon are proven to be useless. And for the third time in the book, Daniel, God's man, is going to come into the room and solve a mystery that nobody else in the empire could solve. But before that happens, another character enters the scene. We're told about the queen. Now, I don't think she was one of the people who was invited to the feast. Maybe she was, and she just chose not to participate in the chaos and the madness that's happening here. She is probably the mother, the queen mother. Maybe the mother of Belshazzar. Maybe some have even suggested the old wife of King Nebuchadnezzar, who is still alive. But regardless, she is this dignified woman of experience and wisdom, wisdom that nobody else seems to have. There is chaos and mayhem in this room. The experts are at a loss. The 1,000 lords are no help at all, verse 9. But for the second time in verse 9, we're reading that Belshazzar is greatly alarmed. His color is changing. There's nothing but foolishness in this room. And so wisdom has to enter from the outside. The presence of God enters into this room with this message. The queen enters into this room trying to point to Daniel. And then finally, the character shows up that we've all been waiting for. Daniel comes in later after that in order to interpret this message. I think it's interesting that she doesn't use the Babylonian name for Daniel. Did you notice that? She calls him Daniel. And she says, this man is able to help you out with what you need. Remember what Daniel's name means? My God is judge, or God is my judge. And so this man who called that is about to come into the room and give God's judgment to a man who cares nothing about the authority of God, even though he is fully accountable to him. And that's a lesson for us, whether we voluntarily bow our knees to this king or not. He is the one who rules over us, and we will answer to him at the end of our days. And so, Belshazzar is losing his mind, but he is told about someone who can help him with that, and now Daniel comes in. Let's read verse 13 through 28, down through most of the chapter. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king answered and said to Daniel, you are that house of Judah whom the king my father brought from Judah. I've heard of you. The spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing, to make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation,
You shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself. Give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his spirit was lifted up, when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of this house have been brought in. You and your lords and your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways you've not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Pharsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your king is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. What a dramatic scene. So Belshazzar sends for Daniel, and really he had no choice in the matter because the queen has stood up in front of everybody and said, this is what you should do. He goes ahead and he does it. And when Daniel comes into the room, he does not really get a glowing reception from this Belshazzar. He gets kind of a demeaning reaction to that. So verse 13, notice the cheap shot. Oh, you're one of those exiles. You're one of those Jewish slaves that Nebuchadnezzar, my father, brought in from that foreign territory of Judah. By this point, think about how old Daniel is. He is in his 70s, if not more probably his 80s. He is an old man, and he has lived the majority of his lifespan, not in Judah, where he was taken probably as a teenager, young man. He has now lived the majority of his life in Babylon. He knows their languages, he knows their literature, he knows their ways probably better than most of them did, quite frankly. And yet, he is still, at this stage of his life, treated as an outcast, treated as somebody who is not part of the accepted in-crowd, because the true people of God, this is the way that we are always treated by the people of the world, that we are weird, we're strange, we are conforming our lives to a crucified king that nobody else wants to obey. That is anathema in the eyes of the world. And that has always been the case, even in the time of the Old Testament. And so, the tone of Belshazzar seems to be, okay, well, let's take you off your shelf. Let's dust you off a little bit and see if your batteries still work, if they ever did. Because you notice what Belshazzar says, I have heard of you, verse 14, verse 16. I've just heard about you. I don't actually know what you can do, though. You haven't proven yourself to me, although people speak nicely of you. Also, in verse 16, did you notice, if you can read the writing, contrast that with the confidence that Nebuchadnezzar showed in Daniel when he figured out what he could do. Chapter 4, verse 9, Nebuchadnezzar said, I know that the Spirit of the Holy Gods is in you. I know that you can help me out with this latest problem that he had back in that chapter. Belshazzar does not have that kind of confidence in this Daniel who is brought in before him. But Daniel is going to help him out. However, before Daniel obeys his job description of the moment, he was brought in order to read that interpretation, and he's going to do that. But before he does that, he is going to go into lecture mode a little bit on this upstart, second-rate monarch that he has been brought in to serve. And so in Daniel 4, you remember when Nebuchadnezzar saw the tree and it was getting cut down, and Daniel's brought in, and Daniel goes, oh no, I have to tell you about this. I really don't want to tell you about this. I wish this was for your enemies and somebody else and not for you. And remember, at the end of chapter 4, Daniel tries to give him some counsel and advice. Here's how you can prolong your prosperity so that this doesn't happen to you quite yet. There's none of that kind of language in this chapter. And this doesn't mean that Daniel is some sort of jerk to Belshazzar. It just means that he's going to let the message come. He's not going to feel alarmed about it. He's not going to express any regret, and he's going to give no advice to this king who is going to die this very night. And so he issues a stinging rebuke to this king who, as far as I can tell, has never seen him before. And what he essentially says is, you knew better than to do what you have done in this moment in time. Why did you ignore a lesson that was right in front of your nose? As great and powerful as Nebuchadnezzar was, you knew about what happened to him and how God took him from his throne and made him eat grass and made his fingernails grow, living like an animal until he understood God rules and not him. Do you realize, he says to this king, God holds your breath in his hands. You remember as the Apostle Paul would later say to the Athenians in chapter 17 of Acts, in him we live and move and have our very being. We exist. Our molecules are held together because the God who created us wills it to be so. We can do nothing without him. And so think about the applications that we can make as people of God who now find ourselves in the last days, who now find ourselves at the very edge of when history tips over into the final day when Jesus comes back. Belshazzar had the story of his father, his predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, in front of him. What do we have in front of us? All of the revealed teachings and stories of all of the people who came before us in this book. We are without excuse if we reject the ways of our king. But sometimes I see young Christians of my generation choosing of their own free will to marry themselves to people who do not care about the ways of Jesus and have not bowed the knee to him. Even though they know the story of Solomon, they know the stories of the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they know what Paul says in Ephesians 5, how marriage is a picture of Christ in the church. Sometimes I see married Christians who harbor bitterness and resentment against each other, even though they've read the book of Hosea before. Sometimes I see Christians who are full of grumbling and complaining about various aspects of their life and their relationships and their congregation, even though they know the stories of Israel in the wilderness in the book of Numbers. And they know how that turned out, but they do that anyway. Sometimes I see Christians who refuse to be patient with each other and talk out issues and problems in a constructive way in a local church, even though they know what Paul says to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians. And then sometimes I look at my own heart in the mirror of this book and the stories that it contains, and I see things about myself that I'm trying to warn other people about, that I'm struggling with for me. That should not be the case. Paul says that whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, but it is up to us to receive the instruction that God gives us in stories like this. And so we may not praise the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone like they're doing here, but sometimes we do praise false gods in our hearts, don't we? Gods of anger or lust or envy or bitterness or fear or pride. We know better. We know better. May God give us the strength to do better. Let's finish up the chapter. Read with me verses 29 and 30 through 31. Then Belshazzar gave the commands, and Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. I want us to think about this final scene that we've got here. Now, in contrast to what we've seen before in this book, when Nebuchadnezzar is brought down, when his understanding is taken to a lower level, when he is deflated, think about his reactions to all those times. In chapter 2, he fell down on his face in front of Daniel, and he said, "Wow, your God is a God of gods." In chapter 3, he blessed the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he said to his entire empire, "I don't want anybody to speak anything against this God." In chapter 4, he praises the Most High God at the beginning and the end of the chapter. But what does his son do when he is confronted? Think about some of the ways that even some of the most wicked people in the Bible reacted to the impending judgment of God. Remember in 1 Kings 21 how King Ahab, who Scripture says there was no king like him who sold himself to do evil like that, even when he killed Naboth, and Elijah said, "Oh man, God is coming for you." Do you remember what the reaction was? Ahab ripped his clothes, he put on sackcloth, and he mourned about that. And God said to Elijah, "Oh, you see that? We're going to tweak this judgment a little bit." Do you remember what happened when King Manasseh, who was the worst king that Judah ever had, just about? Do you remember how he was dragged by his nose off by the Assyrians outside of his kingdom because of his horrific sins? We're told that Manasseh entreated the favor of the Lord, 2 Chronicles 33, and humbled himself greatly after he experienced that really painful moment. But what does Belshazzar do? When he's told about what that writing on the wall is talking about, of how this is it for you, for your empire, it's being given over to the enemies that are outside of the gate, he does nothing to praise this God. He does nothing to repent of his sins. All he does is bestow these meaningless honors on a man who doesn't want them on behalf of an empire that is about to become extinct. There's so much irony, so much sadness even, in what we read in verse 29 and then what we read in the very next verse, at the beginning of verse 30. Remember in verse 10, the queen comes into the room and she says, as a lot of people say in books like this, O king, live forever. And yet, Belshazzar would not even survive the night. This man, whose name means, O Bel, protect the king, is left unprotected by his gods. His name is a Babylonian prayer to these deities that he was worshiping and serving when he thought everything was going well, and he's bringing in these vessels and he's praising these idolatrous gods. But those gods that he praised did nothing to help him avoid the situation in verse 30 that he found himself in. The enemy, as far as I can tell from history, the enemy was just able to march into Babylon. The gates were just opened for the enemy to come in, and they go straight to the palace and they kill this man and they take away his power. But what did this mean for God's people? This meant the end of the Babylonian rule and reign that God prophesied would be coming to an end. But what did this mean for the Jews? We have a phrase that sometimes we like to use. One man's trash is another man's treasure, right? Well, one nation's destruction or judgment is another nation's deliverance. What happened to the Jews after this moment? Well, they are given the green light by the Persians and the Medes to go back home and rebuild their lives and to rebuild their temple. And what do they take with them? The vessels of the house of the Lord that God said were going to come home one day. In the prophecy that was read to us before we started this sermon, in Jeremiah 27, God says, I'm coming for what's mine. And that didn't just mean some vessels that were used in the worship of the house of the Lord. That also meant his people. He's coming for his own, and there's nothing that the devil can do to stand in the way of that from happening. Let's read this again. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning the vessels that are left in the house of the Lord, in the house of the king of Judah, and in Jerusalem, they shall be carried to Babylon and remain there until the day when I visit them, declares the Lord. Then I will bring them back and restore them to their place, this place. Remember, as Daniel opens in Daniel chapter 1, the vessels of God are one of the first things that's talked about in the storyline, that Nebuchadnezzar comes and he grabs people and he grabs things of God. And then he comes back eventually and he grabs all the things and takes them away. But Jeremiah was told to prophesy to the people that a restoration was going to happen. Let's bring this home to us. If you are a disciple of Jesus Christ, you are his precious treasure. You are his. And he is coming for you. And there is nothing that the forces of darkness can do to stand against that. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Romans 8. And that's a rhetorical question, but he goes on to answer it. Nothing can. Sword, distress, famine, persecution, there's nothing the devil can have a say about with that. The writing is on the wall for Satan and his forces. And so the encouragement and the challenge for all of us here is, are we found in this Jesus who is coming for his vessels, for his people, for his treasures? He will have what is his. But the question that we need to ask ourselves now is, are we his? Are we sitting in his treasure room waiting to be seized by the Lord who is coming? He has the power and the desire to restore you to himself. But do you want to be restored? Is a question that we all need to ask and answer in our hearts. And so if we can help you,
with that question today. We're going to have an opportunity now. You can come forward as the song is led, or after the service is over, you can talk to me or one of the other men, and we can help you with this. That's part of the purpose of our assembling together is not just to worship our great God, but to also assist each other in our spiritual lives if we can be of service. And so please think about this as we stand up and as we sing the invitation song.